I don't know if you ever think about your life, and this sort of thing springs to mind. I did a bit of a search around on the internet, and you find lots of these things of how to be extraordinary, how to live an extraordinary life. And almost every case, when you find one, you scroll down the page, and there's a place to send some money to a person who's going to tell you how to live an extraordinary life, how to... I think this is suggesting if you go and stay on a rock halfway, looking over a beautiful bay, you'll have an extraordinary life. I don't know. But so much of advertising in particular, isn't it, is this idea where we're told that if we buy the correct car or perfume or watch or jewellery or whatever product, then our life will suddenly turn around and be extraordinary and we'll no longer have an ordinary life. And likewise, if we spend any time on social media, it's the same sort of thing, isn't it? You see people's the good parts of their lives, and you forget that they've only posted the one good thing that happened to them that day, and they've neglected to tell you the disasters they had in between, or whatever it might be. And sometimes we can fall into that trap, can't we, thinking, everyone else is having an amazing life. Look at what's going on their Facebook page. I wish I had an extraordinary life like that. Maybe our life is a bit more like this. Maybe we think of our life as ordinary and we feel a bit stuck, and this is the other side of it, isn't it? If we don't have an extraordinary life, maybe we feel we have a bit of an ordinary life. And this is, I think, is an advert, potentially for a diary that will change your life if you feel that you're stuck to a wall in that particular way. But I think if we think too much about ordinariness and extraordinariness, because that's the title of the chapter of this book, and that's what we're going with tonight in this series, but maybe actually if we think about, rather than our ordinary lives, because that has maybe a bad connotation, we think about extraordinary lives versus ordinary life, we maybe just think about, more helpfully, our day-to-day lives. And this chapter of the book that we're looking at now, the book You Can Really Grow, we've been following it through in this evening service, chapter by chapter, week by week, and we're on growing in the ordinariness, or growing in the day-to-day of our lives. And I guess by very definition, a lot of our lives is the day-to-day bit of our lives. It's the nitty-gritty, it's the day in, day out, whatever your Monday morning looks like, and it's probably different for most of us, but you have a fair idea maybe already how your week's going to plan out, what things are going to fill that week, what your day-to-day existence is looking like this week. And yes, I'm sure for a lot of us, we have these fantastic times where we grow in less day-to-day ways. Maybe some people have been to the big church day out recently. AJ and myself and Johnny and a few others are going to the CVM Men's Weekend Away coming up. And those sorts of events for me, and I used to go to Spring Harvest when I was growing up as a kid, and these yearly events, Soul Survivor and others, are fantastic. They're fantastic times where you can grow in your faith. You're in a kind of a unique situation, thousands of Christians meeting together, you have the big worship events and everything's a little bit different. But that's not the day-to-day of our life, or if it is, you've got a slightly different life than maybe the rest of us. Something needs to pay for the chance to go away today, so you need to do the job or the rest of the life to be able to do those. They're fantastic things, I'm not knocking them at all, and we can grow in those, but what the book's trying to get us to think about is actually, we also need to be growing in the day-to-day of our lives. If we just hang on for that big yearly event or that big thing to happen, and that's the only time we grow in our lives, we're missing out on so much more. So growing in the ordinariness of our lives, growing in the day-to-day of our lives. And it says in the book this, "And it is ordinary, not extraordinary. It happens in the nitty-gritty of life far more often than in single, extraordinary, transformational ways." Yes, God can change us in those big events, but often I found when I went to something like Spring Harvest, the challenge was actually to carry on with that growth when I got back into my daily life. It's a bit easier to grow as a Christian when you're only surrounded by Christians and you don't have the realities of what your life looks like outside of that particular thing. So sometimes we need to think about not just looking to grow in the big transformational events, which God can absolutely do in our lives, but looking how we grow in the day-to-day. And actually, I just want to look at one character from the Bible, Moses, the great man of faith talked about. And we're actually going to look at Moses from the New Testament, in case you're just flicking back to Exodus to try and find it. If you want to flick to Acts 7, I'm not going to read the whole section. I'm going to pick out a few verses and we can see a bit about Moses' life, at least from a high level. Acts 7, and we're going to look through verses 20 to 33 to understand Moses' life. So it starts off in verse 20 talking about how Moses was born, and it does say he was no ordinary child. He had interesting upbringing. He lived with the Pharaoh's daughter and was brought up as her child. And so obviously the privilege that went with being in the household of the royal family, if you like, and everything. So he was brought up in that time in a bit of a different way than any of the other Israelites. But in this summary, we see in Acts, where Stephen's summarising his life, the next bit he jumps to is when Moses is 40 years old. So already 40 years of his life has gone, and we have a bit of an idea, but not a lot of what happens. He was educated in this way, so he had something extraordinary there, but there would have been a lot of day in, day out of his life. And we have this story of Moses when he's 40 that we might be familiar to us. He decided to visit his people, the Israelites. He saw one of the Israelites being attacked by an Egyptian. He decided to take revenge. Things ended up badly, and he fled. And we see down verse 29, he fled to Midian, where he settled as a foreigner and had two sons. And the very next verse, after 40 years had passed. At this point, Moses is 80. He lives to 120, two-thirds of his life, before we even get to the burning bush. So he has all this time, and we just know that basically in that time he was married, he's had kids, but he was working as a shepherd, the day in, day out orderliness of his life. If he was only growing in the big times, actually that period of the burning bush and the escape from Egypt and all the stuff that went on in Pharaoh was out of his whole life was small, because then, after that escape and everything happened, he spent 40 years wandering the desert, which I'm sure there was a lot of orderliness going on there, despite other big things as well that God was working. Moses' life, Moses, this big example of a huge man of faith in the Bible, had a lot of growing in the ordinariness. If he only grew in those times, clearly when God speaks to you in a burning bush, that's going to have an effect on your faith. But we would have to imagine that Moses was growing in the other times as well. So we've seen what the book is trying to say to us about growing in the ordinariness and why it's important. But what does that actually look like? The book takes us through three characters. We'll see their names here: Joe, Laura, and Stan. You're going to find out quite a bit about them over the next 10, 15 minutes or so. As far as I can tell, they're fictional characters, but the author of the book is a minister in a church. And I imagine that these are a combination of different people, if not an outright person who just changed the name to protect them. They seem like very real people. That's what I guess I'm saying, is that they might be fictional, they might have been made up a bit to fit in with a chapter of the book, I give him that, but they do seem like real people, and as we read through, we'll understand what that means. Just a little bit about them to start off before we look at some of the areas of their lives. So Joe, the first person there, he is, I guess, in his mid-20s. He's married to someone called Sarah. They met at university. Next up in our cast of characters is Laura, who's married to someone called Dave. They have two young children. And Laura has recently become a Christian, but her husband, Dave, isn't a Christian. And that obviously makes things interesting for her and him in their lives. And finally, we have Stan, the third one on the list there, our third character. Stan, for many years, was married to someone called Peggy. Sadly, she died recently, and he's now adjusting to life as a widower. So as I'm talking to them, they sound a bit, I guess, like real people. It's hard to distinguish that. And actually, maybe for us, as we're saying this, some of these characters relate to us in a personal way or relate to someone we know in a church. We can see some people in the church as we read through these. So Joe, Laura, and Stan. And we're going to look at, based around the verses that were read to us before in Ephesians, about how these three characters grow in their lives as Christians, grow in the ordinariness of their lives, and grow as Christians in different areas of their lives. And the first one up there, the verses, this is the verses in your Bible that will match up with what was read to us earlier. This comes, if you can't make out all the text up there, this comes from Ephesians 5, 22 to 27, this particular section. And these are these quite familiar verses on marriage. And that's one area for a lot of people. I know not everyone, but for a lot of people, that's one area that makes up, without sounding derogatory, the ordinariness of our lives. Marriage is when we got married, Jem did a talk, if you remember, if you were in the church at that time, and he puts together the names. And my wife and my names is Matt and Debs. And he did, marriages are demanding, marriages are dangerous, and marriages are delightful. And I think there's a bit of all three of those things. He also had the words mad, and he was very worried about the acronym in pictures of him with the word mad in front of him. But there's a bit of those three things, isn't there, in marriages, if you're familiar with marriages. And these verses are tricky, I think, in some ways. And I'm not going to do a whole thing on all of it, but I am going to acknowledge that actually there's a bit in here that sometimes people have an issue with, because it talks about wives submitting to your husbands, and it follows up with husbands love your wives, the two bits highlighted there. And that's a whole service on its own, and I'm not going to go into all of it, except to say a couple of things, is that you need both. It's not just a one-way thing of, like, wives submit blindly to your husbands, and the husbands rule the roost, and that's it. If the husbands are going to love your wives as Christ loved the church, that means something significant. So if it's the word submit is tricky, sometimes it talks about the word respect later on, and there is a lot there. But there's this two-way thing in a relationship, and it's talking about how the respect and submission and the love from the husband and the two things tie up, but it's all pointing to Christ. It's all pointing to Christ's example. Christ and the church, Christ, the church as the bride of Christ, and those sorts of things. So it's talking about that. So have that idea in mind if the words around submission and those sorts of things are trickier. So how does this look like for our three people? We have our cast of characters. Well, Joe, as we said before, is a recently married younger person, and he says, the quote in the book says that Joe is finding marriage wonderful and awful and is struggling to understand it all. And maybe that's the reality for some people. Going from being two single independent people coming together in a deeper relationship, you have to learn to compromise. You have to learn to love the other person even when you don't feel like it. So the first example, Joe is learning to grow as a Christian by looking to Christ for the example of his marriage, praying that he can love his wife in the same way that Christ loved the church. On to Laura. Laura, as we said before, has been married for a little bit longer, and she's recently become a Christian, and as it stands, her husband hasn't followed her, doesn't have the same ideas about faith and church that she does. We're still on marriage, really. And so she's struggling in her faith to love her husband, who is someone who doesn't love God. But the way she's finding it easier to grow in her faith as a Christian is that actually she realises that her husband was made in God's image. He might not have the faith that he has, he might not have the relationship with God that she has, but she's thankful to God that her husband is kind and good and made in his image. She constantly prays for him and gets her home group to pray for him as well. She invites him along to social events to try and show him what other Christians look like, to try and give him an idea of what a faith in Jesus looks like and what it means to other people, particularly some of the men in her home group, so he can understand what that means. Finally, within marriage, onto our third fictional character, Stan. Stan, if you understand the situation, is learning to look at marriage in a different way since he's lost his wife. He's learning, though, to grow as a Christian by learning that even in his grief, God can help him grow in his faith. He also feels that he should try and engage with some of the new married couples in church to try and give a perspective on marriage from someone who's had a long and faithful and fruitful marriage to encourage them. But maybe for us there's something in that, that God actually, in the ordinariness of our lives, sometimes the ordinariness of our lives equals a time of grief, a time of sadness, and that God can even grow us in those times. And maybe for you, you can look back on times in your life where tricky times happened, bad events happened, but you can look back after a while on that event and see that God was helping you grow. So we have these individual people who are looking to grow, in this case, in the marriage, in the ordinariness of that part of their lives. But actually, part of it is that they're growing amongst a group, a community of a church. This is not something we do on our own. And when we're talking about our day-in, day-in, day-out lives, actually, it's very beneficial to have a group of Christians in the church that we can share that with. Some of us are part of home groups, some of us are part of prayer, triplets, all these sorts of things outside of the church on a Sunday morning, where we can share a deeper way in our lives with each other and actually share about the ordinariness of our lives. What does our life look like Monday to Friday? What do we struggle with in those things? Sometimes they're not always big things, and sometimes it's hard to share those sort of more ordinary things. But actually, as you build up relationships, you can be open and honest with people and say, do you know what? I struggle with my work. I struggle with motivation. I struggle with my marriage. All these sorts of things. That's far easier in a group where you've built that up. On to the second part of life, family life. The verse is a bit further on in Ephesians. There's two parts here. The verses are probably familiar to us, and we heard them read earlier. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, and secondly, fathers, do not wind up, I guess, is another way of saying it, your children. And I was very challenged reading these verses, thinking about what I've put my children through this week. And it is a challenge, as parents, some of you might know. There are a couple of things that are interesting. The first part, there's not really an age limit on this children obey your parents. It's not children obey your parents if you're under 18. I mean, it obviously is that as well, but in a sense it extends. So it's obeying our parents, honouring our parents throughout our life. And that means different things. You know, I don't need to obey my parents in terms of getting ready for school at the right time when I was now than when I was 15. But there's a sense that I need to obey and honour my parents as an adult. And what does that mean? What does that look like? And then the flip side of looking at parents, if you're a parent, how you bring up your children, how you instruct them in training of the Lord, how you model the idea of Christ to them, how you relate to them, all those sorts of things. And so our Christian faith can grow in these situations, whatever our family situation is, whether we see our parents a lot or a little, whether you have children or don't have children, whether our children are older or younger, there's different ways we can think about how we relate to family life. And of course the wider family life of brothers and sisters as well fits in with this. So going back to our cast of characters within their family lives, so we talked about Joe and Sarah again, they're newly married, they don't have children yet. But they're dealing with one of those times of life that, if anyone's been through it, it is a bit tricky. When you first get married, you have this thing of trying to work out how it all fits together. You've gone from being a child, maybe at home, or at least, you know, in that sort of relationship with your parents. And the verses here are clear that husband and wife leave their family and join together in marriage. And it's how you work that out. Probably the first time for me, and maybe most people it comes up, is what do you do on that first Christmas? Whose house do you go to on Christmas? You know, it's those sorts of things, it's those arrangements. How do you balance that up? How do you spend time equally with your parents and your in-laws? How do you make sure that you have a good relationship with both sides of your family? And again, it's similar if you have children as well, and that's in the equation. But there, if we look at this couple, Joe and Sarah, and they're striving to do the right thing, they're striving to honour their parents whilst at the same time respecting their marriage and understanding that's a new relationship, that's a commitment to them. And they're growing in their faith by praying about it and sharing with their home group. And actually the flip side of this in these characters' lives, they found that actually their home group was able to encourage them to say, that's really good that you're striving to do that, because 2 years ago you weren't and we've seen a change in you. And sometimes that's part of it for us as well, isn't it? Actually, sometimes people just need an encouragement. Do you know what? That thing you used to struggle with, you don't do it anymore. That's really good that you've changed that around in your life with God's help. Sometimes we need to tell each other that. Sometimes we need to be encouraging to each other. Then on to Laura, the lady with older children. She's learning to rely on God quite a lot to provide the patience to deal with her children. And particularly, if you have children, you'll know this time of night, the 7 o'clock pre-bedtime time is a very tricky time. And if you have children, that's not a tricky time. Please come and speak to me afterwards. I'd like some tips. Because the children are tired, you're tired, it's been the end of the day, you're trying to fit all this stuff in. The adults would like to go to bed, but can't because they've got lots to do. The children don't want to go to bed, but should because they're tired. And anyway, you can kind of imagine. But the example that she shows is that she's growing in her faith by learning to rely on God. As we have more and more, whether it's around children or even if we don't have children, we have more and more of these times in our lives where we need to realise that we need to rely on God. And we can grow in our faith by giving over more of those times to Him, by praying in more situations, God, I can't face this situation, I need your help, and letting Him help us, putting someone to walk alongside us in that situation, giving us the right words to say, whatever it might be, so we can grow in the faith of our ordinariness by praying for God to help. And finally, on to our third character, Stan, in his family life. So he's recently become a grandparent as well. And the book says this great quote, he's finding new ways of exasperating his children now that his children have children. And if you're in that situation, you might understand that, of the desire to help. He wants to help his children parent their children, but not make it come across in such a way that it's unwanted advice, shall we say. And there's a balance. And he wants to grow in this. And he genuinely wants to be able to help in this situation. He wants to do the best for his children and his grandchildren. And the example they give here of how he grows in this is actually turns to the Bible and looks to how Jesus relates to people. We think about Jesus a lot about teaching and preaching and the miracles and stuff. But there's a lot of times where Jesus relates to people in a direct way that works exactly for that situation. Whether he notices the person that no one else notices, whether he talks to the person that no one else talks to, whatever it might be, Jesus was very good about relating to individual people in a way that meant something to them. So maybe if we're seeking to do something similar, maybe if we're seeking to come alongside someone, we can look at Jesus' example about how he came alongside people. And finally, on to the third set of part of life. In our Bibles, it talks about slaves and masters. Hopefully, for most of us, that isn't the reality. I think, other than fairly exceptional circumstances in this country, we're graciously not in a situation where we're slaves and masters, although it obviously goes on in other parts of the world. But when Paul was writing this letter, the setup of slave and master would have been the standard way of work for quite a lot of the people reading the letter. So whilst we're not slaves and masters, or as much as we might sometimes feel it, depending on what our boss is like, we can take some ideas and the principles of this and equate them to employees and employers, bosses and us, whatever our situation might be. So we think about, firstly, Joe. He's in a situation at work. He's just started a new job, and there's five or six people who started at the same time as them. They're all on a training scheme, and they know at the end of the scheme that only a few of them are going to get the job, or the plum rolls anyway. And maybe that's the situation for us at work. We know there's other people who are going for those promotions. There's other people who are almost become our rivals, even if we don't want to see it that way. And sometimes that is the reality of work, isn't it? We're called to work hard and we're called to do well in our jobs. And it's how you balance up the doing well in your job. You don't want to be the Christian who's a doormat and does everyone else's work and they get away with it. But you probably at the other extreme don't want to be the person who is always getting ahead at the expense of others. And it's how we do that, how we live that out in our works. What does it mean to be a Christian in our workplace? What does it mean to be working for Jesus, as it talks about in these verses? And so maybe one way we can grow in our faith at work is actually, as it talks about in these verses, realising that Jesus notices everything that we do. And if we're just working for human approval to get a promotion or to look good to the boss, then we're missing out on what these verses are saying to us. These verses are saying that working for Jesus means something different. Doing our work for something outside of human approval. Our second person, Laura, her job is a teacher, and some of you might identify with this. What it says about her is that actually she as a teacher is becoming slightly more cynical around how she sees the children that she's teaching. And I know, not first-hand, second-hand, because my wife is a teacher, I know the day-in, day-out reality of being a teacher, and it's hard work. And you just, I guess, most of the time wanting to do the best you can for the children, but you have all the other stuff that goes on, and sometimes the children aren't always agreeable and things like that. So Laura in this situation is actually trying to grow as a Christian by trying to see the children she works with as made in God's image, not just a misbehaving pupil or annoying colleague. And maybe there's the challenge there for us. What would it look like if we saw our work colleagues, not just as someone who's on the desk next to us or we see in the canteen or whatever it might be, but if we saw those people as made in God's image? What would that mean? How would we treat them differently? How would we behave differently? And another side of it is that it talks about how Laura's been trying to make a positive influence in the staff room. Maybe this is familiar to you in your jobs. It's a lot easier in work to criticise things that have gone wrong, isn't it? And sometimes it's not easy to praise the things that have gone right. I know certainly that's true in my line of work, because everyone is very easy when we have a look back at how things have been. You get a lot more answers of when things went badly that people want to moan about it than actually people saying, you know what, this thing went good, that went well. Maybe that's the way we can look to grow in our line of work. Looking to be a positive influence, looking to be someone that actually points out when things are going well. And finally, the last character in the situation of work. We talked about Stan before, so he's retired. And he has a situation where things are switched around a bit in his work. So before, in his job that he had, his fictional job, he was... an employee, and now he's retired, he's found actually he's in a position of influence over other people. He has someone who comes in to clean his house day by day, and he has to realise that he's basically their boss. And also he's been put in charge of certain events and works at the church, and he's in a role overseeing that. So for all of us, we have maybe these two sides. I don't know if your job, you class yourself more as the master or the slave, you're the boss or you're the employee. I don't know which way around it is. But we have a challenge in all those roles, don't we, of how we behave, and particularly if you're in a role of influence over other people. You can potentially make their lives tricky, and it's how we behave as a Christian in those roles. What's the right way for us to be an influence over other people? How should we treat other people in our jobs? So we have all these characters. We have these fictional characters existing in their lives, going about their lives in different situations, whether it's marriage, family life, work. But actually what brings them all together in the book is that actually they're all part of a church, and in fact, even more so, they're all part of the same home group. And this quote in the book sums this part up. It says, "It is no surprise, though, because it is the church that grows together in Christ." And so part of this, for the challenge for all of us, is even if we didn't identify with any of these people and none of these life situations rang true for us, maybe we know some people in our home group, maybe we know some people at church who these situations do line up with. And so there's two parts to it, is actually maybe we need to look, if these situations ring true with us, maybe we need to look about how we can grow in the ordinariness of our lives, using the examples here. But the other side is that maybe we can encourage someone else we know who's going through one of those situations. A few years ago, I lost my job quite suddenly. And it's amazing when that sort of thing happens, you find out a lot of people have been in a very similar situation. For several weeks at church, after it happened, people coming up to me and saying, you know, I had something very similar happen. And it's actually quite encouraging to hear that, because from what I remember, all those people were currently back in work at the time they told me. But it's just good to share that, isn't it? And I'm sure, I know it happens, I've seen it happen in so many other things, where people have an illness and someone else has had a similar illness. There's something about that connection where you can share from a point of actually having been through the situation. Sometimes we have to just, you know, get alongside people even if we haven't been through that situation. But there is something powerful about saying, you know what, I've been through that situation, this is how it worked out for me, maybe you could try this, these sorts of things. We can get alongside each other, we can bless and encourage each other, we can pray for each other. So to finish, what's the encouragement, what's the challenge we can get out of all this? Or hopefully across all those stories there may be at least one person or at least one situation that rang true, although I realise that they can't cover every single life situation. But there's a couple of quotes I want to end from the book to end with. So it first of all says this, "And a place where we grow is in the ordinary nitty-gritty of a standard weekday, in the unglamorous surroundings of home and work. This is where the great cosmic purposes of God are worked out. This is where we can grow." The main challenge of this chapter of the book is realising that actually a lot of our life is the day-to-day part of our life, the ordinariness of our life. And we need to think about how we can grow in those times. And it's a struggle, isn't it? Because actually, when you look at, you know, I know if I look at my work situation, I find it hard enough to do my job, let alone imagine what it's like to grow my faith. But that's the challenge from this chapter of the book. That's the challenge from some of these verses in Ephesians, that we need to look at these different areas of our lives and not just see them as not just put everything in boxes. One box is our Christian life at church on a Sunday and everything else is separate. The idea that all these things come together, and look at the ways that we can grow in our faith, grow as Christians throughout the week, whatever our Monday to Friday is. So to end, there's two bits. An encouragement. It's encouraging this because actually the reality is there's no time that is not a time to become more like Christ. If we're saying that we can grow in the ordinariness of our lives, that's lots of times in our lives where we can look in lots of scenarios and think, is there a way I can grow my faith? Maybe some of the stories we've heard tonight or other ones. So there's lots of times and lots of opportunities. Probably from the moment you leave here tonight till the time you come back next week, there'll be multiple opportunities to grow in our faith in the ordinary situations that we come across in our lives. That's the encouragement. But on the flip side, the challenge is that we're saying that there's no time, and the book says it like this, there is no time to clock off from striving for growth as God lifts us up. There's lots of opportunities to grow in the ordinariness of our life. It does mean that We're encouraged not to see it as just growth on extraordinary times, not just growth on a Sunday morning, not just growth when we're around Christians, whatever it might be. We're encouraged to grow in all areas of our life. Amen.